Recording has started.
Okay, so welcome everyone to the October 28, 2020 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference. Craig, if you'd take the roll.
Sure, I'll just read what I have here. Kat McGuire, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, David Roll, Vern Tishman, Greg Glazer, Jessica Coco, Carl Golovin, Lynn Cornelison, Malcolm Arnold. Let's meet. Get over to page two. Marie Spike, Marty Hopper, Mick Harrison, Pat O'Connell, and Peter Ketchum. Did I miss anyone?
Oh, you missed Gregory Longo. Gregory Longo is here on the phone with me.
Oh, okay. Oh, great.
And Stuart Nelson is on with me, Pat O'Connell.
Okay. So Greg Longo and Stuart Nelson. We'll add those two names. Sure.
Okay, great. And do we miss anybody else?
That's everybody I have.
Okay, great.
I don't know if anybody else.
Okay. Are there any objections to the agenda as written and sent out? Okay. Hearing none, then we'll assume they're approved, and we can get started. So we're blessed tonight to have two good speakers with us. Are going to share lots of good information with us. Our first speaker is Greg Glazer, and Pat O'Connell is going to introduce him to us. Pat?
Okay. Greg is a California attorney and constitutional law advocate who serves as general counsel for Physicians for Informed Consent, a nonprofit organization of physicians, scientists, and attorneys united to safeguard informed consent in vaccination. Greg has educated lawyers, legislators, and the public on vaccine case law and precedent, and he's been helping parents and schools navigate California's draconian vaccine mandate. Last I checked, he had 100% success rate getting unvaccinated kids back into school. Hopefully he can update us on that. And as my boss at PIC, Greg currently spearheads our projects developing videos and media opportunities for our doctors to educate a variety of audiences about infectious diseases and vaccines. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and Greg, before you get started, I'm just going to put us into lecture mode so that I've got to just unmute you, so just please bear with me a second. Okay, Greg, you should be able to be heard now.
Okay. Well,
great.
Don't I have an extraordinary power now? The only power to speak, which is actually quite similar to informed consent, which is the issue that I'll be talking about today. Each one of us has a voice, just as each of us has a body.
Sorry, Greg, sorry to interrupt. Is there anything you can do that would kind of increase the volume of your voice? You're coming in very kind of quiet, and some people may have a bit of trouble hearing you.
Yeah, yes, thanks for mentioning that. I'll try to speak up.
Okay, great, thanks.
Sure. So I'm calling in on a landline. So hopefully you can hear me clearly now. So our rights originate with the U.S. Constitution. And we have many rights. We have the right of free speech, First Amendment. We have the right of bodily integrity, Fifth Amendment. Go back to the First Amendment again, we have the right to free exercise of religion. And all these rights come into play in vaccine lawsuits. And when we look at the landscape of vaccine lawsuits today, we're generally acclimated to losing those cases, which is very unfortunate because judges are deferential to established science. And the mainstream science is in favor of vaccination because of essentially slogans and misdirected research. Basically, pharma science has dominated the landscape. For example, the phrase safe and effective has been repeated so many times that it has become, for all practical purposes in court, it has become true. So much so that a court in California recently took judicial notice of vaccines being safe and effective. I mean, that is just a shot across the bow to what science is supposed to be. Science is supposed to always question. And to just claim without citation to any numbers that vaccines are safe and effective is called is scientism rather than science. Scientism is just belief and trust in experts rather than actually looking at numbers and examining the evidence for yourself. So my goal with a new lawsuit, which is imminent, I will be filing it very soon. I have all my evidence prepared, is to present the actual numbers, to present a pilot survey of unvaccinated Americans that shows what their health is. And their health is extraordinary. These are the healthiest people on the planet. And the likelihood that we would be able to survey the health, specifically survey the medical diagnoses of all of these unvaccinated people, and they happen to be this healthy, they happen to have this few chronic illnesses, such an infinitesimal amount of allergies, ADHD, asthma, developmental disorders, digestive problems, they hardly have anything at all. And when you compare that to the general population, and the general population, above 99% of Americans have received one or more vaccines. So all you have to do is look at the national data, and you can tell what it's like to be vaccinated. You know, the rate of chronic illness, the rate of heart disease, rate of cancer, et cetera, et cetera. So all you have to do is compare the vaccinated to the unvaccinated. And you can see very clearly what it looks like to be in a country that is suffering under vaccination. I mean, to look at this evidence numerically and see and just imagine what it would be like to live in a country without all this, all these allergies, and without all these neurodevelopmental disorders, without all the heart disease and cancer. I mean, it's like looking at this evidence is like going back in time. It's like a time machine looking at these people. These are the healthiest people on the planet, the unvaccinated. I mean, it's what everyone wants for their own family, you know, to be this healthy. It's extraordinary. I mean, I might as well be, it's like I'm looking at the Amish or something, you know, it's like just a flashback in time. And so the evidence speaks for itself. The evidence is numerically valid. It's numbers. We counted the unvaccinated, we counted their medical diagnoses, we compared it to national data, and we calculated what our confidence interval is, we calculated what the p-values are, and put it all out there. And so this is coming, and this is what the future of litigation looks like. A very smart lawyer, a very wise lawyer once told me that there is easy litigation and then there's hard litigation. The easy litigation is where you just go in and say, hey, I have rights, you know. The hard litigation is where you go in and you say, my rights were violated because X, Y, and Z, and here's my hard evidence. And so the future of good litigation, in order for us to start winning in court, it's got to be the hard litigation. We've got to go in with the evidence. It's not enough just to cite the Constitution and say, you know, where's my due process? Where's my informed consent? Because then we get slammed with the phrases, you know, all of those phrases of safe and effective, even though it's devoid of numbers. All those phrases like, you know, well, you can't put someone else in danger because of your own, you know, choice. It's like, but really, are the unvaccinated putting others in danger? So we also calculated the exact risk of being unvaccinated in America today. And it's infinitesimal, the risk. It is, I mean, just to provide an example of what it would be like, the vaccination bargain. It's like a vaccination is like someone hitting you in the face with a baseball bat. And the alternative, being unvaccinated, is like picking up a stick off the ground and holding it in your hand. And then someone, would you like to choose between these two options? You know, you would obviously choose taking control of the little stick and putting it in your hand compared to getting hit in the face with a baseball bat, because that's what it looks like when I look through all of these chronic illnesses, just one thing after the next. Everybody knows somebody who's vaccinated, has had one or more vaccines, and has a chronic illness. Most everyone does. And so it is this pervasive problem. And I'm an elephant in the room type of guy. You know, I'll keep pointing to the elephant, even if it's uncomfortable. We're suffering right now. Our nation is dying. We're dying here, okay? We're not going to have a nation at this rate. At this rate of chronic illness, if we keep this up and this many people are sick and have autism and have developmental disorders and infertility, if we keep up these trends, we're done. That's the elephant in the room. And I'm going to keep pointing at it and saying, we need to fix this. And our scientific institutions have been pointing at all sorts of other things. They're trying to point at the little ant in the corner and say, well, maybe it's gender. Maybe the reason that we're having all these issues is gender confusion, or maybe it's race, or maybe it's, you know, such and such. It's like, no. How about maybe the cause of all these immune-related disorders is the one thing that is designed to alter the immune system? Vaccines. You know? It's like, where did biological science go? It seems that corporate science took over this whole field of vaccinology and did a major distraction game with the public and just sold the public on this idea of the social justice sciences, where it's always some socioeconomic, sociopolitical factor. Like it's that we could just stratify the results. You know, let's survey 1,000 people and stratify them. Let's just classify them all according to their own little categories, you know. Oh, you're black, you're white, you're Chinese, your religion's this, or you know, your genetic profile is this, and such. You just stratify it all down, and then at the end of the day, you say, well, we just can't figure it out. We don't know what it is. We don't know what's causing all these problems. Nobody's looking at the elephant in the room in mainstream science. And so it's incumbent upon litigators like myself who are willing to take on the hard litigation, go into court, and present the hard evidence, the best evidence, the real numerical evidence, and not take no for an answer. Not walk in and be apologetic and say things like, well, even if vaccines are safe and effective, we just want our rights. No, I want my nation. I want to live in a country that is healthy. And I want to know these numbers. I want this exposed. And the time for pandering to pharma is over. They are destroying our nation. We know it. Everybody knows it. But people just know it in different degrees. And they don't know the full extent of it. And the only way to really bring home the full extent of the problem is to show the hard evidence. And that hard evidence begins with the survey, the health survey, the study of the vaccinated versus unvaccinated. And you know how I know that? Because it's the one thing that pharmaceutical companies will never study, that established science, the medical establishment, they will never study the unvaccinated. They will bend over backwards to never look at them. In fact, they're so afraid of the unvaccinated that they claim, try not to laugh, even though you're all on mute, they claim that it's unethical to even study the unvaccinated. They say, no. If you find someone unvaccinated, you just need to shoot them up right then and there with a vaccine. We cannot even afford the time to ask them questions about their health. Just vaccinate them right away. It doesn't make sense. Pharma is so afraid of the unvaccinated because, as I know, and you know, and so many people are learning, the unvaccinated are the healthiest people on the planet. Completely blows away the whole narrative of safe and effective while our nation hangs in the balance. And that is the stakes that we face today in this year, in 2020. when we have people clamoring for new vaccines, for getting caught up on the flu shot, for a warp speed vaccine. It's reached a fever pitch where the unvaccinated have been vilified. The healthiest people on the planet, the ones whose very bodies hold the key, hold the evidence to the health of this nation, the survival of our country, America, survival of America hangs in the balance. And what do we need to save our nation? Control groups. Good science. Simple, actually. A court's job is to uphold the Constitution, preserve evidence, do equity, things like this. These are the things that I'm talking about. I'm asking for preservation of evidence. I'm asking to preserve the control group. I'm asking to uphold the Constitution, to prevent discrimination based on vaccine status, based on vaccination status, to uphold informed consent. And by informed consent, I also mean informed refusal. Those are the same ethical and legal principle. The right to consent to a medical treatment is also the right to decline consent to medical treatment, as the Supreme Court has said. And so this is the landscape that needs to be present before courts today. And we need smart lawyers, we need smart expert witnesses to put it out there. And we need judges that are fair and willing to hear the evidence and recognize the elephant in the room. So, thank you guys for hearing what I had to say about vaccination today and litigation, and I welcome your questions.
Okay, thank you, Greg. And that was very powerful. I have to say, if I ever need a lawyer, I'd like you. You're very good. I'm just going to put us in Q&A mode here. And so you just press *6, everyone, if you want to ask a question and get in the queue. And Greg, while we're waiting for people to sign up, I wanted to ask you, were vaccines always bad, like even back in, say, the 50s and 60s, and like, are people that are getting chronic illnesses like now that are older, could that be also from the vaccines? Oops, I think I have you muted. Just a second. Okay, Greg, you're unmuted.
Okay. Yes, the answer is vaccines have always been dangerous. Vaccines have been associated with the spread and shedding of infectious diseases, as well as triggering the immune system to react to whatever is in the vaccine. Vaccines have, especially the older vaccines, were the subject of contamination. Edwin Black, for example, recently did a lecture on that at UC Berkeley, where he, you know, chronicled the history of vaccine corruption. But even if the vaccine is perfectly manufactured, it is still inherently dangerous. And these vaccines, they get credit for eliminating diseases that were already on the way out. So, for example, you can look at whether they were already on the way out, or alternatively, that their impact was already de minimis. For example, what we can show is that the number of cases of chickenpox, for example, was already decreasing. The number of cases of the mortality rate of chickenpox was already decreasing before the vaccine was even invented. The same, you could show the same with measles. Before the measles vaccine was introduced in 1963, there was an absolute drop-off in the mortality rate from measles before 1963. So measles was not killing people. It was killing very few people at the time when the measles vaccine was released. But the measles vaccine got the credit. And the question is, what is the harm? You know, what's the cost of this vaccine? And so when we look at it, for example, what Physicians for Informed Consent showed, our organization, is that you have, for example, a 5 times greater likelihood of getting seizures, epilepsy, if you get the MMR compared to the measles. And so that's just one example, just one disease, epilepsy, where you're worse off if you get the vaccine. And then and that doesn't even consider the benefits of actually getting the measles. The benefit of getting the measles is, well, first you get a natural lifetime immunity. It's the Cadillac of immunities, as Del Bigtree likes to say. I love that. And compared to the MMR, which is the Pinto of immunity, you know, and it can harm you. It wears off, and it is a flawed system. It creates a dependency upon just vaccine after vaccine. And so part of the answer to your question of, you know, were the older vaccines better, is that they didn't have as many adjuvants, and there weren't as many of them that they gave. So in that sense, I guess it was better. But today, the name of the game in pharmaceutical and in vaccinology is antibodies. So in order to get a vaccine licensed, the manufacturer has to produce antibodies. That's how they evidence immunity. It's a total racket, but in any case, that's how they do it. And so in order to generate as many antibodies as possible, you basically have to shock the immune system into action. So that's why they keep adding more and more adjuvants, more and more preservatives to basically make your immune system so shocked that it reacts. It's almost like, you know, my example of getting hit in the face with a baseball bat. It's like a Major League Baseball player hitting you in the face with a baseball bat compared to a T-baller, you know, hitting you in the face. You know, one is just this, whoa, hey, what happened? And the other is, oh my God, what happened? You know, the new vaccines, they try to hit you really hard, then, which is why they've spiked the adjuvants.
Thank you. Okay. Okay, and our first person to ask a question is David Rolls. David, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. I liked your talk, and I have four questions. I don't know if I can get through them all. I'll try to be quick, or else we can come around to me. So first, like, how can the unvaccinated people be super healthy when there are other poisons in the environment, like the fluoride and chlorine and other things they put in our water, and the glyphosate and other poisons in our food, and the air pollution from the geoengineering and from, you know, from smokestacks and stuff. So how do you account for that? That's the first question. And then the second question is, doesn't big pharma like control the whole world, not just the U.S.? So like, wouldn't it be important to place all this within an international context instead of just saying we're saving this country, like trying to save the whole world? And then the third question is a big question, like with.
So David, let me ask you.
Stop. Okay.
Let him answer those two, and then we can get the other ones out after that. Okay.
Cool.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
And the answer to your first question, David, why in a polluted world, a world with fluoride and air pollutants and so forth, how are the unvaccinated still so healthy? Well, the answer is twofold. Number one, the human body is resilient. As long as we don't mess with it, meaning mess with the immune system, trigger the immune system, it has the ability to handle those toxins so much better. And on multiple levels. Not only are children less likely to develop chronic illnesses, they're more likely to have only small issues with those chronic illnesses. So, for example, they're less likely to have multiple chronic illnesses. They respond much better to infections. You know, they recover quickly. So that is the answer to that question. And secondly, that was the first answer. The second part of that yeah. of that answer is that families that don't vaccinate, they also tend to be pretty savvy on other items as well. And your second point is, or your second question relates to international. We're not just saving America, we're saving the world. That is true. When every nation, what's in the best interest of America is in the best interest of the world. For us to protect Americans and create a healthy America, that helps the world. Twofold. Number one, as an example to others. And number two, because any court order, any precedent we have can immediately be used by lawyers in other jurisdictions. For example, if I win a case tomorrow and get a court order in the jurisdiction of California, a lawyer in England can take that same court order the very same day and introduce it into a court in England under a doctrine called judicial notice, which recognizes court orders from other jurisdictions, even across international boundaries.
Okay, David, and you have two more questions?
Yeah, so I mean, how are we going to get the truth to stick in court or in the political system or in public opinion when the you know, the narrative is like so dominated by big money and mind control? Like, I don't know how we can do it.
Sure.
That's the third question.
Yeah, well, the mainstream media has been exposed as the enemy of the people, and every day people are waking up. I think that there's polls done on the level of confidence in the media, and it's at an all-time low. So it's actually, pharma has the same approval rating. It is so low. I think it's even lower than lawyers and car salesmen. I mean, pharma has one of the worst reputations ever, which is why whenever you see a commercial for pharma, they don't show a pharma executive, do they? They show a doctor, because doctors have a high approval rating, and pharma knows that. That's why they're always saying, talk to your doctor. Here's a picture of a doctor. Here's a picture of you taking a drug. Look at how happy you are. Actually, they don't even show you taking the drug. They just show you living. And so it's a total system. People see right through it. People make jokes and parodies of pharmaceutical ads all the time. So their days are over.
Well, I hope so. You'd never know it from the amount of people who, like, object whenever we say anything against vaccines, you know. So. And then the fourth question is kind of specific. Like, I hear that some of the COVID vaccines are going to alter people's DNA and turn people into genetically modified organisms, or they're going to use nanoparticles of aluminum or other metals that are going to allow the 5G technology to, like, directly control people. And I mean, I don't believe all that stuff. I think it's kind of scaremongering, but I was wondering your opinion.
Thank you for asking. Yeah, I mean, there's the conventional answer, which is what these new RNA DNA vaccines do, and then there's the more unconventional answer, which relates to wave propagation and how things can interact and be programmed just using waves. And I think your question was kind of geared toward that, but I'll just answer the first question, the conventional answer, which is that the new style, the new way to create vaccines is these RNA DNA vaccines, where they alter your cells. They get into the cell, and it turns your cell into a vaccine manufacturer. Basically, your they take a snippet, part of the actual antigen or the disease itself. They take a part of the disease, and they put it into your cell, and so your cell learns to manufacture this. They learn to manufacture the antibody to this, to what was injected. And so it effectively alters your intracellular composition and therefore makes you yourself the vaccine manufacturer. It turns your body, and essentially your body becomes a vaccine maker, which is new and different and scary, compared to the old way, which was just the straight antigen model, where they would just inject the antigen along with the whole antigen or a dead version of it into your tissue, and then wait for your body to swarm it, and then, you know, you produce antibodies in response. And that's why they include things like aluminum, because it will trigger your body to recognize the foreign substance and immediately attack it.
Okay, so the new style of vaccines, are they, like, much more dangerous and you can't detox from them, et cetera, like I hear?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's hard enough detoxing, you know, your tissues. But, I mean, when you talk about detoxing that what's inside your cell, I mean, that's detoxing on a whole new level. That is just, I mean, that's why these things, we're talking about permanent changes to your body, you know. You're altering your DNA, and that's you know, you're altering your cells on a level that cannot be treated through conventional medicine. And then also alternative medicine is not equipped to do these kinds of detoxes. It's entering a brave new world of frightening manipulation of the human immune system.
Okay,
so a good resource that explains all of this, I would refer you to the NVIC conference, the presentation of Vicky Pebsworth, PhD. She did a very good explanation of the new types of RNA vaccines.
What's the conference called? Okay, so have these new kinds of vaccines not been used so far? Are they new with the COVID vaccine?
They are new, correct.
Okay.
The technique itself has been developed. It's a recent technique because it comes from the genetic the field of genetics. And the vaccinologists, established corporate science, they could not be happier about this new technique because it allows them to make vaccines very quickly, whereas the old approach involved much more trial and error, much more tinkering to try to find the right formula, quote-unquote right formula, that could create as many antibodies. This new method is the question becomes, can they just inject it? Can they just get it into the cell? Because they already know what the snippet is.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Greg, who did you say the person was who spoke at the conference? Vicky somebody?
Yes, Vicky Pebsworth. She is the science director for NVIC, the National Vaccine Information Center.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, and then we have a question next from Carl Gullivan. Carl, go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for your presentation. My question goes back to the 60s. I was born in 57, and I think there was a great popularity in giving kids tonsillectomies and removing their adenoids in the 60s. I was one who went through that, and I think it's since recognized that tonsils and adenoids are kind of part of the immune system. And just wondering, it'd be interesting if there's for one thing, to compare the frequency of those operations in the earlier years of the 60s versus today. Also, I wonder what the effect or what the health effect has been long-term on the fairly large population that had that operation in the 60s.
That's a good question. Yeah, I wouldn't know that one offhand, but I'm certainly interested in the answer.
Okay, that's all I had.
Okay,
thanks, Carl. All right, next we have Malcolm Arnold. Malcolm, go ahead.
Yes, thank you so much as far as your information. One of the things as far as how vaccines interact with the body, in the military, there's an expression, prepping the battlefield. And what vaccines actually do is they prep the biological battlefield to make one more susceptible to what you're actually being vaccinated for, along with a host of other things. So I'm kind of curious if you've ever heard of someone who maybe someone that you'd like to read their material is Dr. Raymond Obomsawin. Obomsawin. He was the head of the health for the Indigenous people of Canada. And he has a 7-hour lecture series on the histories of vaccinations with Indigenous people, and shows that the historical data that when the settlers came to the Americas to settle, the native population didn't have smallpox for 70 years, but yet the settlers did. And one of the reasons he gives a host of scientific data throughout his and historical data through his presentations, but he shows that it was the change of diet and that what happened was a change of diet. So you have a 70-year period where the diet is slowly adopted of those settlers, and the native population goes away from their original diet. So I'm kind of curious if you could talk a little bit, if you know anything about nutrition and how it goes. And what's very interesting about his presentation, it was done 10 years ago, and I'd love to see him update it again. I've been trying to research him and find out if he'd updated it. But he gets into how megadoses of vitamin C and other things that you can do to actually protect yourself once mandatory vaccinations come in. He doesn't talk about it then because that really wasn't a topic in 2010. But basically he talks about how certain vitamins and supplements can actually, in megadoses generally, can really help, especially vitamin C, can help with adjuvants and the vaccines. Do you know anything of those things? And then I have a follow-up question later.
Sure, yeah. Well, the first answer on diet is that there are no studies showing such drastic changes between one diet and another. For example, you won't find zero ADHD in one diet group. You know, so take two groups of people. Okay, both are fully vaccinated, and one of them has like a vegetarian diet or an Atkins diet, or you know, you name the diet. You will never find a study that shows that there's dramatically lower, like 5,000 times lower ADHD, allergies, any of the things that I've been talking about. Not one study. So that's the answer to the diet question. It's not diet that's killing our country. And in fact, what dietary science shows is that different people can benefit from different diets. There's different body types. But what the science does show is that vaccines is the common thread. If you take out the vaccines, and now you compare the two groups, it doesn't matter what diet they have. You have dramatically lower, 5,000 times, 6,000 times lower rates in the unvaccinated group. In some cases, you cannot find a single example of something. Like, for example, I didn't find any diabetes in my control group. The odds of that is astronomical. I mean, it's astronomical odds. I just have plenty of diabetes cases. I should have plenty of autism cases, etc. But I'm just not seeing it. And if you try to do the exact same study with fully vaccinated people and you change their diet, you will never find what we find with the vaccinated. And secondly, so now that you know that, anyone coming to you and saying, oh, don't worry, get vaccinated, a.k.a. let me hit you in the face with a baseball bat, I have a great remedy to fix your face. Don't fall for it.
Okay, all set, Malcolm?
So, as far as with vaccinations coming, do you have any information on vitamins and stuff like that? And then the information on Dr. Obasalam, if you want to see his videos, they're on YouTube, on a YouTube channel called Amazing Discoveries. It's a life science seminars, and then he wrote a book called Universal Immunization, Medical Miracle or Masterful Mirage, if anybody's interested. But especially as far as anything that once you have to take a vaccine, is there anything that you can do to mitigate the risks if you know that you're going to have to take that vaccine? Like you can prep for it in some way, like taking, you know, megadoses of vitamin C. He was talking about intravenous vitamin C megadoses and stuff like that.
Yeah, the idea of vitamin C is that what you're trying to do is oxidate your cells. As strong oxygenated cells are the best defense against all sorts of infections, viruses, and ailments. And then the same can be said for detox. You know, what you're trying to do is you're trying to flush out your system at any reasonable rate that works for you of those toxins that tend to lodge following vaccination. So those are two things. One, number one, oxidize. Number two, you detox. But number three is basically you cannot control it. It's just prayer. Like the idea is that you're basically hoping the vaccine doesn't work, that it doesn't trigger your immune system to react to whatever's in that vaccine. For example, if they put eggs in the vaccine, well, you're going to start reacting to eggs because the vaccine trains you to fight eggs. It thinks eggs is the problem, right? And so it's the same thing with anything you put in the vaccine, aluminum or varicella or inactivated polio. Like no matter what they put in the vaccine, you will think that your body will think that's the problem. So now you start fighting it. You know, you fight everything that's in the vaccine. So now you're fighting your egg sandwich. You're fighting the aluminum, you know, which is, I mean, good luck going through a day without running into aluminum, right? It's in everything. It's everywhere. It's in the air. So you become a constant fighter. And so your original question of, you know, priming for the battlefield, you couldn't speak truer words. You know, it is you become a fighter, you become a warrior. And you know what the problem is with that on a daily basis is that the human body is not meant to fight every day. Soldiers are not meant, you know, just look at these boxers, right? You know, they look pretty good in their prime, right? At 18, but then look at a professional boxer in, you know, 5-10 years, you know, he can barely hold it together. You know, they're falling apart, especially the brains. I hope that analogy is helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, Malcolm. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, next, and the last question we have in the queue here is, last person is Kat McGuire. Kat, go ahead.
Thank you. Are there any organizations that are figuring out how to legally not have to take the vaccine? And if what ways can we do to avoid the vaccine? I know they're going to put up a lot of barriers. You can't go to school. You can't get on the transportation. But what can we legally do to truly put teeth in it that I will not be vaccinated?
Thank you for asking. Yeah. Well, fortunately, we had very good advocates in the 18th century that really helped us out. They drafted our Constitution, right? So I think we've always gone back to that, you know, which is our constitutional right to due process, meaning bodily integrity, our right to the free exercise of religion, meaning that, you know, you can have a religious exemption, and the battleground, you know, and then later on that history, that original constitutional history evolved with the freedom of choice movement, you know, the health freedom movement. You know, originally I think it was like the Anti-Vaccination League, you know, and it was in America and England and Canada. And then, obviously, you know, today we call it the health freedom movement, and the battleground has been over these statutes, you know, at the state level, which is, do we have exemptions? And all adults have exemptions, with the exception of, you know, there's some states where they'll say, well, teachers have to get a flu shot or another shot, and healthcare workers, you know, there's some issues there that'll come up, and so that's where and then, of course, students. It's always been about these students. You know, so the battleground is who has the exemptions. And now, in 2020, we are on the cusp of the warp speed COVID vaccine, right? So I know a lot of people are worried about that, but my advice is don't be. President Trump has us protected. He's already said multiple times that the vaccine will be voluntary. He said that on camera multiple times. He has said that the vaccine will be a matter of national security, which means federal preemption. That means that the states, the localities, they cannot mandate it. The states, they do not have jurisdiction. Governor Newsom cannot mandate the vaccine because it's a matter of national security, federal preemption. Trump even went so far as to say that the military will be involved with the distribution. It does not get more federal preemption than that. There's nothing more than the military coming out that says federal preemption. So don't worry. As long as we have President Trump, we don't have to worry about mandatory vaccination. If under a Biden presidency, though, I have no words for that. It's over.
Well, I have a feeling the whole Constitution is going to be eviscerated at some point anyway, as we march into this, they force march us into the New World Order. I just don't know if I trust the ability of constitutional lawyers to be able to argue their case at that point. You mentioned religious exemptions. What religion should I join so that I can get an exemption?
The answer is that you should love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And if you find who said that, you'll find the way.
Well, who are getting the exemptions in terms of religion?
The answer to the religious exemption question is that you're not required to be a member of any organized religion. The Supreme Court has recognized that spirituality itself can be a religious belief, and the only question is one's sincerity in that religious belief. And so, generally, if a person is known to be sincere if they engage in religious practices. Often that involves reading a religious text, attending some religious services, but it doesn't have to be. And so it can just be a general spiritualness. You know, my body is a temple. And different states have different standards for what qualifies for religious exemption. And we've had to litigate over that issue. We're actually currently litigating that issue in California next week with the University of California. They issued a mandate to vaccinate 510,000 of their employees and students. And the vaccine is the flu shot that they're trying to force on everyone. And so when we sued them, they said, well, we'll give you a religious exemption. But then they set up these tribunals, these like religious courts, you know, their own little ad hoc religious tribunals, and nobody knows what to expect. You know, do you get a religious exemption? What's the criteria? So it becomes a big mess as to who qualifies for what. It's been a huge issue in New York because they did the same thing in New York with the students. They set up these religious tribunals and they try to grill you. I mean, basically, the name of the game for pharma is, in the state, they're trying to make it hard. They just try to make it hard for people to get exemptions because that's, you know, when you read their medical journal articles, that's what they're all about. It's all just this policy of increasing vaccination rates and decreasing exemptions, and they talk about it openly. So they are very antagonistic to religion in any form. But some states have great, you know, religious exemption rules. So, you know, a lot of it will depend on which state you're in. But again, you know, unless you're a healthcare worker, probably don't have to worry about adult vaccination in any state.
Hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So, Greg, I just have one last question for you myself. This is Cheryl. Is there any connection between vaccines that people may have gotten, you know, in the 50s and 60s that are now creating all the Alzheimer's and dementia in people?
Yes, I think so. I think that there is, you find dormant issues. And that's exactly what our pilot survey showed. I mean, first off, finding unvaccinated adults, oh my goodness, do you realize how hard this is? There are a diamond in the rough just to find them. But when you do, it's a joy to find a truly unvaccinated adult. But these are the healthiest people. They go through their whole lives and have hardly any chronic illness. It is remarkable. They don't have arthritis or Alzheimer's. It is remarkable how healthy these people are. And, you know, compared to the average adult, you know, our national statistics say it's something like 60% of adults have one or more chronic illnesses. And that is so high, you know. That is outrageous. I mean, you know, our ancestors, if they saw that, they'd say, what are you doing? You know, and that's the national data that they're, you know, that they're reporting on. I mean, the number, I think, when you talk to fully vaccinated adults, I mean, good luck. Just go ahead and try to find me anybody who's fully vaccinated and doesn't have health problems as an adult. So,
wow.
No, I'm all ears. Anybody?
I had another one here. Do you know of any sources, or maybe you could tell us yourself, good ways to detox if you've had these vaccines? Especially if you've had them for, you know, 50 years or 40 years or something.
Yeah, some of the best detox remedies are chlorella and spirulina. And some people also really like bentonite clay as well. And when detoxing, and also exercise is a great one, because you just naturally flush stuff out when you exercise and then, you know, take a shower. So it's the sweat that gets it out. And so when doing a detox, the idea is that you're dislodging stored foreign substances, metals, viruses, you're dislodging that from your tissue. And then where does it go? Well, it goes into your bloodstream, which is then filtered, and the goal is to get it out by excretion. And that process of, you know, flooding your bloodstream with toxins, well, it looks a lot like sickness. You know, it looks a lot like getting colds and runny noses and inflammation. And so when people start a detox, if they detox too hard, you know, like maybe eating too much chlorella, then it can look like they're getting worse before they get better. And that is especially true for people with very serious chronic illnesses. They're just trapped in a hopeless loop because the more that they detox, the more they just inflame. For example, epilepsy is one of those things. You know, it's very hard to detox epilepsy because you just flood the blood with the very things that cause, you know, like grand mal seizures, and it just escalates. And it's, yeah, I mean, you can kill the person just detoxing. So that's why, for example, doctors will say, you know, if you're going to do a detox, you want to do it with under the supervision of a doctor. But that's just what they say. You know, you don't have to. It's just if you have serious conditions, you might want to at least take it slow at first.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And Kat, did you have another question? I see you're here again. Let me just – no, you're already in there. Okay. Great. That's it, Greg. Thank you very much for joining us and giving us all that information. And that's great. That's great to know that the evidence is out there. And thank you for all the work you do.
You got
to protect us from
guys.
That. Okay. Oh, wait a minute. I see a few more questions here. Some people have just signed on. Are you up for two more questions?
Of course.
Okay. Malcolm, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to go over spirulina, bentonite clay, chlorella, and there was one more that you mentioned.
Exercise.
Excellent. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, and then Jessica Coco. Jessica, go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to bring up, because of what we've been discussing, Jules Verne wrote a novel called Paris in the 20th Century, and it was written in 1863. And what's really interesting about the novel is he talks about how people are so healthy because of indoor plumbing that they forcibly vaccinate people to make them ill. And he talks about in the novel how Big Pharma makes its profits, which, of course, you know, capitalism makes its profits from selling illness, and how they're going to cure illness by making people ill. And he talks about how people are chronically ill in Paris in 1960.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that pretty much sums up the model of pharma today. And I think that there are those who do it willingly and those who do it unwillingly, you know, who just profit from the system without knowing. And, you know, that's the latter group. And the former is those who know that they are harming people. They do it intentionally because they're sick people themselves, which I suppose is ironic. But we as a people have a great opportunity to reclaim our destiny. And I'm really glad that you brought that up this point, because there's probably one of the most important things that I have to say is this, you guys. So of all the things that you're going to hear today, hear this. Everything is for our benefit. Ultimately, I know, you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who's more opposed to vaccination than myself. But even I recognize that vaccination has the potential to help us in some way. And I don't say help us in the sense that it's going to, help our bodies. No. I think it helps us in the sense that it's a lesson. It's a lesson that teaches us as a society, this is what happens when you interfere with natural biology. And that lesson, once we learn it, can save us from a much greater threat. And that much, because there is a greater threat than vaccines, as terrible as vaccines are, and you guys know how terrible they are. I told you, they're destroying our nation. There's something that can destroy our nation with much more finality, with much greater force, and that is the looming threat of what a vaccine really is, which is it is a biotechnology. Vaccines are, it's a technology, it's manufactured in a lab, and it is integrated with biology. It's a patented biotechnology. And the field of biotech is producing new technologies that are more invasive, that are meant to basically take over human biology. Just as vaccines take over the human immune system, there are new technologies coming from biotech to take over the human brain, and it's all categorized with this word, transhumanism. And so when I say that vaccines have the potential to help us in some way, I'm saying vaccines can wake us up as a people to transhumanism. If we can just learn that vaccines harmed our biology, maybe we should think twice before other biotechnologies, all these other transhumanism forms. We can save the species. Because I think the evidence is already clear enough where people are going to wake up to vaccines. We wake up at the expense of not learning the lesson, that will have been the greatest tragedy of all. If we don't learn the greater lesson that our species is threatened by transhumanism, then all of this pain and suffering in vaccines would have been for nothing. And for me, that would be the greatest loss of all.
Okay, all set, Jessica?
Yes, thank you so much, and thank you for
Okay, and then, Greg, we do have two more questions, and then we'll cap it there. So, Kat, go ahead.
Yes, this is a quick one. You mentioned bentonite clay. What about diatomaceous earth? Is that close enough cousin to use that too?
The answer is that diatomaceous earth is good for deworming. What it does is worms, parasites, those little things that creep, when they interact with diatomaceous earth, it cuts their outer shell. And when it cuts it, when it lacerates it, they lose the ability to thrive, and in some cases they will die outright. So it's a kill-on-contact type remedy. And so if you take a small teaspoon, for example, of diatomaceous earth and put it in some water, then that can be a remedy. A lot of people give it to their pets to deworm. There's an entire field of medicine that focuses on the field of parasites and what that looks like. How many of these diseases are actually related to parasites? It's one of the grosser areas of medicine when you look into it, but it's obviously very important. I think one of the most wise things said about parasites is you can spend a lot of time trying to kill them, which, using things like diatomaceous earth, or you can spend a better amount of time making your natural environment, your body, uninhabitable for them, which means, you could be trying to kill parasites your whole life. They're kind of everywhere. You're going to get them in the air. You're going to get them from your pets. You'll always have a parasite problem. But if you can create an internal environment with good diet and exercise, et cetera, that parasites don't like, then that will be the lasting cure. That's the best way to handle parasites. But, for a serious parasite issue, like a present current one, yeah, diatomaceous earth can be quite helpful.
Okay. I'd just like to add one little comment. There's a woman named Dr. Christiane Northrup, and she has a very interesting analogy of what we're doing. She says, take a fish bowl, put a fish in it, and dirty water. What they want to do is vaccinate the fish, and what the terrain people are saying is change the water, get clean water.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Okay, and Greg, the last question is, do most countries in the world have these massive vaccine programs like we have here in the U.S., or are there countries that don't do that?
Thank you for asking. It's hard. You're hard-pressed to find countries that don't vaccinate in the UN era, because thanks to the United Nations and Bill Gates and their groups, you know, like Gavi, they've made it their purpose to exterminate the unvaccinated. It is a form of genocide. They're trying to kill and extinguish unvaccinated no matter where they are. They will get them whatever vaccines the country will accept, whether it's DTaP or whether it's a measles vaccine, whatever the country will accept. They will bribe the leaders of these countries. And so what you find is a hodgepodge, a mishmash of different vaccine requirements in different countries. But no country has escaped the clutches of these international pharmacists going forth and vaccinating the world. And so it emphasizes even more the importance of the control group in America, because some of these other countries, they don't have the same protections, the same legal protections, the constitutional foundation of freedom that we have in America, you know, the right to informed consent, the right to say no.
Okay. Well, that's depressing to hear, but thank you. So that's the end of the question. Greg, thank you again so much for joining us and for all that you do. And we have another speaker's talking. You're welcome to stay and listen, or I know you're busy guys, so if you need to go, that's okay too.
Thank you so much. It was so nice to be here.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so we're going back into lecture mode, and now we are going to hear from the Lawyers Committee on their latest efforts concerning anthrax. And I guess I don't see Dave Meisingel on, but I see Mick Harrison. Let me unmute you, Mick. Okay, so Mick, are you able to, I know Mick, David was going to be here, but as I said, I don't see him here. Are you able to go ahead with this?
I could. I want to give David a chance to speak up if he's hiding somewhere on the call, because he was planning to do this. Are you sure he's not with us?
All right, so let me unmute everybody and see if we're missing, if Dave is. Dave, are you with us? Dave Meisingel?
Don't hear him.
I thought I saw his name up here earlier, and then it disappeared, so he may have had to go to do something.
I'll leave it to you. If you'd like me to proceed, I can.
Sure. And if you'd like, I can try and contact him while you're speaking, if you'd like him on.
I think a deference to him as our executive director would be a good thing, to at least make an effort to reach him, but I can start, and if he doesn't show up, I can just sort of do what he would have done.
Okay, great. So let me put you in lecture mode. Okay, and Mick, and if you want to get started, I'll try and catch up with David.
Okay, very good. So, folks, we wanted to give you an update on the Lawyers Committee's activities. We have a number of things that are either have taken place since we last talked or have sort of moved along. We have, as I think you may remember, 5 active federal lawsuits in federal court at the moment. And we have now not only our petition to the U.S. Attorney and the grand jury in New York on the Trade Center demolition issues, but we now have a new petition in the sense of a legal filing under the First Amendment, not in the sense of a list of signatures asking, you know, a representative to do something, but this new petition is to the Congress, and you can find it on our webpage. You go to the Lawyers Committee webpage, which, if you don't know, is lcfor911.org, and look at the top, you'll see anthrax petition, something like that, to Congress. You can click on that link. It'll give you a menu. You can pull down the full text. You can pull down the executive summary, which is only 2 or 3 pages. And then you can also pull down the exhibit list, which will give you active links to each of the exhibits. I think there were like 69 exhibits to this petition. For those who don't remember, and most of us probably did remember because we lived through this time, there was a second wave of attacks after 9/11. This was the letter mailings of anthrax, a biological weapon, that started a week after 9/11 and proceeded through September and October, unfortunately killing five people, injuring at least 17 others, probably more, and requiring thousands to take antibiotics. And it was sort of a second wave of terror, exacerbating the trauma of 9/11 itself. The FBI investigated those anthrax attacks for 8 years, from 2000, maybe 8.5, 2001 late to 2010, and claim to have found the perpetrator, blaming those attacks on a lone wolf scientist from an Army facility in Maryland. There have been a number of critiques of the FBI's investigation over the years, from independent scientists, Dr. Barbara Hatch Rosenberg, Dr. Martin Hugh Jones, Dr. Merrill Nass, attorney Barry Kissin. There have been editorials from the New York Times and the Washington Post calling for new investigations because they found the FBI's work unsatisfactory, as did all the independent scientists I just mentioned. And the Lawyers Committee decided to take a new look at the evidence on the anthrax attacks because of those prior independent critiques, which we found persuasive and disturbing. There was also a ProPublica and PBS documentary, if you haven't seen it, still available on the web. And so there were a lot of unanswered questions about these anthrax attacks. And the Lawyers Committee decided, because this really was the second wave of the 9/11 attacks, and from our point of view, you know, our concern is that, as you know from our first petition on the Trade Center regarding the use of explosives, that there's a lot more to 9/11 than has been disclosed by the government. And it's unlikely that the perpetrators of the demolitions of the Trade Center buildings were the 19 hijackers who allegedly perished in the plane crashes. So the question is, you know, who did the World Trade Center demolitions, who were the perpetrators? And if that question is unanswered, then for us, the next question would be, well, who really perpetrated the anthrax attacks? And so we decided to look at it. And for a period of 8 months, we immersed ourselves in a number of the critiques and the documents available. And if you haven't discovered it, the FBI has posted 59 collections of documents on its Vault webpage regarding what's called the Amerithrax investigation. You can read those documents. It'll take you some time. And then there was the NRC report, National Research Council report, in 2011, which came out, strangely enough, after the FBI's investigation closed. But that report was commissioned by the FBI itself, and the FBI asked the NRC to evaluate. That might be Dave. Let me pause for a moment, see if it is Dave. Cheryl, can you tell me?
Yeah, how you doing, Mick? I'm here.
There he is.
Folks, how you doing? I wasn't sure.
Yeah,
the
most
time.
Of them are muted.
So Dave, I started the introduction to why we got into the anthrax investigation. I haven't disclosed our findings, and I can, if you wish, I can turn it over to you, and you can do what you had prepared to do, and then if there's something you want me to speak to, I can sort of fill in at the end, unless you prefer me to keep on going.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we do what we plan to do, and you fill in on the RMR 1029, all the scientific work that you were following up on.
Sure.
Okay, very good. All right, well, thank you for inviting us to be with you. We have been doing some very intense investigative work in the last 8 months, and it's sort of like a little change of pace because, as you know, we concentrated on the World Trade Center towers, and we have litigation going on in New York City in the Southern District Court. And we also had litigation down in Washington, D.C., around the 9/11 Review Commission. But this is a bit different in that we're talking about anthrax, and anthrax being a biological weapon that was introduced into the United States, at least publicly, about a week after the 9/11 attacks. And again, I'm not sure how much Mick had told you about that, but five people were killed at that time. It was two waves of attacks. The first attack was of a brown, crude anthrax. And the second wave of attack was a few weeks later, which was directed at two U.S. senators, Patrick Leahy and Thomas Daschle, was a fine, dry powder with silicone. And it was aerosolized, which means it was it just like floated and dissipated. It was very lethal, so lethal that on 1 gram was a trillion spores. So just think of that, a trillion spores on 1 gram of this sophisticated anthrax. What the papers and what the administration at that time was basically saying, it was Al-Qaeda had to do it, and the war drums were being beaten there, and preparations to go right into Afghanistan. And then they said it needed a state sponsor, and then there was they brought Iraq in. And the curiosity, though, however, was that the more they looked into it, anthrax in Iraq has a component called bentonite. This didn't have any bentonite. But what it was a strain that was basically indigenous to the United States, was AIM strain. And that led them, the authorities, to start to look internally. And they went through a number of possible suspects. One of them ended up suing them and winning $5 million, Stephen Hatfield, who was a scientist at USAMRIID. And that's the United States Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases. And that's, we know that as Fort Detrick. So then finally they came to Bruce Ivins, and Bruce Ivins was a more fragile scientist, and fragile in the sense that he was very sort of emotional. It wasn't hardened like Hatfield was, and they did the same tricks that they did on Hatfield. They squeezed them, and they squeezed them, and they squeezed them. And finally, on July 29th of 2008, he dies from apparent suicide. However, we're not quite sure that that's how he died. There was no autopsy performed. And some people have told us who are close to him, they believe he was murdered. We don't know that, but you know, we're open to this investigation's continuing. So basically, our findings were, to cut it shorter, that there was a lot of exculpatory evidence to indicate that Bruce Ivins was not guilty of the crimes. And one of the people that actually addressed our body was, that he came before the lawyers committee, was Richard, or Rick, he likes to be called Rick Lambert. Now, Rick Lambert was an inspector with the FBI. He was in charge of the Amerithrax investigation. That investigation was to look into these attacks. And he was there for 4 years. He was interfered with and obstructed so many times. He eventually leaves that investigation after 4 years, gives a 2,000-page summary, which I don't think the public's ever seen. We've never seen it, and we're going to try and get it. He told us you probably have to go to Congress to get it. And in that summary were 16 pages of exculpatory evidence or notes, or however he wrote it up, to indicate that Ivins was not the anthrax suspect. What we found out, too, in doing our investigation, was that in many ways, and Mick will go into this, that the FBI, we like to say, obstructed and corrupted the investigation by the way they handled it, and very poorly, where it seemed that the main suspects that should have been looked at were not looked at. There were indications, Mick will tell you about these morphs, these I facetiously say magical morphs, these four morphs that were supposed to be indicative, or the RMR 1029 flask. That's the key flask here that is sort of they like to indict Ivins with. But there's a thing called B. septilis, which we believe is something that's more germane to Dugway, which was also a simulant or a contaminant in the murder weapon, at least in the anthrax sent to New York City, that really lines up with Dugway proving ground. And there's a microencapsulation and a sophistication for dry powder and aerosolization that matches up with Battelle. So the two of the key areas that they didn't go in were Battelle and Dugway, and there's definite connections with the CIA with Battelle. They were doing three top secret programs at that time involving anthrax. So the FBI not taking the lead to the most common denominators and isolating Ivins. Ivins is dead. They closed the grand jury. This is different than New York City. In New York City, we've never had a grand jury. Down there in Washington, there was actually a grand jury going on. And that was right after Ivins died. They closed the case, said he's the killer, and the investigation was ended. At that point in time, we believe that the investigation should have never been ended because there was the proofs aren't there. The proofs that Ivins was involved are not there at all. Now, we've made contact with at least, a number of scientists from Fort Detrick or USIMRID, and we have declarations that you can read. A lot of this is new to the public. It's never been seen before. Some of the documents that we have are showing. So if you go to the Lawyers Committee, LC4FOR911.org, and on the top page, you'll see section where you can click on it, and it'll tell you about the anthrax petition. It'll show you an executive summary, and it'll basically show you a list of exhibits. There's 69 exhibits. So the scientists there that we've been working with, and these are colonels. These are colonels and are very dignified. Now they're retired as doctors at top-notch universities where they're heads of departments, so very sophisticated and intelligent men. And they all believe that Ivins was set up as a scapegoat. Because of this situation now, we went to Congress. We served 100 U.S. senators and 435 representatives from the House with papers to give them, heads up as to what we're doing, reference to this petition and with the executive summary. Right now, we're marching in time because of the elections and the COVID right now. And after the elections, we'll sort of kick it in gear as far as trying to get publicity and moving forward on this and making contact with more of the people in Congress. Now, they've all received this information now. And we've been in touch with people like Rush Holt, and we've been in touch with some of the top scientists like Martin U. Jones and Barbara Hatch Rosenberg. And Merle Nass is actually on our committee. So we have a real dynamite committee of eight people. There are four attorneys, a doctor, a PhD, Graham McQueen. You might know Graham. He's on it. Merle Nass now is on it. She actually said she'd like to join it, which was really nice for us. And we have key investigators on it, too, that both have master's degrees and have written books and are keen on investigating. So we have a good crew, but we found out now, and one of the reasons we go to Congress is we want them to open up this investigation. Rush Holt and Gerald Nadler, who's still a congressman, they had submitted a resolution, H.R. 720, back then, to try and get an investigation going. And we're going to try and revisit that and have it reopened. At the same time, we're still preparing a larger document. The document we submitted to Congress is 76 pages. This document will be, who knows how many pages, but it's going to be pretty long. But it's going to be more, I can't say necessarily thorough, it's going to be more encompassing, but there'll be some areas we didn't cover in a congressional petition we will cover here, which will be very important, I think, to hopefully getting this open. When we go before a grand jury, what we'll be asking for is a special counsel because we don't believe that the FBI can be investigated properly by the Department of Justice. There seems to be too much of a conflict there. And we have to remember that besides the people that were killed at that time, the five people and the 17 people that were injured, the whole nation was stunned. And this seemed to be connected to the passage of the Patriot Act. And as you know, there was shortly thereafter, at that period of time, a war on terror, attacks on Afghanistan, of course, the war in Iraq for weapons of mass destruction, which were never proved to be there. So we think that this would give the 9/11 movement a lot of credibility with regards to getting our foot in the courts, getting Congress to do something for the people of this country. And it's not a far stretch because they were doing it, all right? What's important is that the we're reworking a road that was already plowed. The only thing we want to do is we'll get a grand jury going with a special counsel and take the evidence, whatever it was at that time, and they'll move forward. We've been told that this document, if you go on our website, lc4for91.org, is the most complete and thorough document up to date regarding this anthrax attacks. And this was told us by none other than Rick Lambert, the head of the FBI Amerithrax investigation for 4 years. So we're really proud that we did that. Again, it took us 8 months to put it together, and it'll take us a few more months possibly to get the grand jury together. And it's sort of like we're changing up a little bit, but really not. It's all part of this 9/11, the crimes, and what's happened since 9/11. We all know how that's impacted on our civil liberties and how we seem to be totally going in the wrong direction. So if we can get, I say lucky, but if we can get some divine help, some divine help, or just maybe some good, brave, courageous Congress people, we might be able to make some significant headway investigating 9/11 through a sort of portal that we hadn't anticipated maybe 2 years ago. Anthrax may be one of the weak links of the cover-up that we can sort of push through, and that we already have congressmen saying they wanted to do it previously, and we have the New York Times wanted to do it. There's editorials at one of our exhibits. We have the Washington Post wanting to do it, one of our exhibits. It's editorial. So, and we have scientists that are behind this. We've taken this to some of the top scientists, as I mentioned before, their names, to review it, and other scientists at USIMRID. So we want to be correct in what we say, because we're saying some serious things. And so I'm going to turn it over to Mick now, and we're going to be here to take some, your questions. I'm sure you may have some questions. And I thank you for inviting us, and hopefully you support us at whatever way you can. And again, that's at lc4for91.org. Thank you.
So let me just punctuate what David is saying. I don't want to get too far in the weeds of our analysis, but the short version, in terms of one of the key findings that, to my knowledge, you won't find anywhere else, in terms of these anthrax attacks, the FBI had developed, with the help of a number of scientists from around the country, some state-of-the-art DNA analysis techniques. The one they used was called polymerase chain reaction method, PCR for short. And what they did was they discovered pretty much by accident through some scientists at Fort Detrick that the attack anthrax had what they call some unusual morphs, some unusual DNA variations. They didn't know they were DNA variations at first. They were just visual differences in colonies that were growing in a sample that had sort of been left accidentally to grow longer than planned. And the scientists observed there were these different morphs, different types of colonies that were visually distinct in the samples. And these were, you know, actually anthrax from the letters that were used in the attacks. And so they decided to see if those differences in morphology, the visual differences, were actually DNA differences, that there were any sort of unique pattern of DNA there that could be used to track the attack anthrax back to its source. And some scientists, including out of Maryland, determined, and one thing I guess we should tell you, which is obvious to us now, but probably not to some of you, that the strain of anthrax used, before we get into the DNA variants, the actual basic strain that was used in the attack turned out to be a military strain, U.S. military strain. It's called the AIM strain. And the government, through the media, initially tried to blame these attacks on Iraq or Al-Qaeda. And it turns out, on a close scientific examination of the anthrax, that it came from a U.S. military installation, either directly or indirectly. So once they identified the strain, they started, you know, looking at the DNA based on these discovery of the morphs. And they discovered that, you know, there was a DNA basis for these differences in the colonies they were observing. So they did some detailed analysis, and they found, the FBI concluded, and I should tell you that the FBI's conclusions were later severely criticized by the National Research Council and independent scientists, but for the moment we'll talk about the FBI's conclusions. The FBI concluded that there were a number of these unusual DNA morphs that, taken together, and they selected four of them, could be considered a fingerprint, basically an identifying pattern that would be unique to the attack anthrax. And if they could just find out who else had an Ames anthrax supply that had these four fingerprint morphs, as they called them, they could basically identify where the attack anthrax came from. Now, that doesn't mean that the source would have been the same as the perpetrator, because as Davis touched on, the attack anthrax was processed, and the second set of attacks much more sophisticatedly processed. So there, you know, whoever got this anthrax from a military facility actually had to process it further into this fine powder, which also had this subtilis contamination, and we haven't talked about, but also had some silicone components inside these four, which is inside the exosporium on the spore coat. I won't get too technical, but the bottom line is there were some unique aspects of this of the anthrax used, which also, in our view, could have been used to track back to the source. So the FBI decided to require, and I say require in quotation marks, the 20 labs or so around the country, and actually three outside the country, that they knew had used Ames anthrax to submit samples of each of their stocks or cultures of Ames anthrax to the FBI, which were all put into this repository, and then all those samples were analyzed using this PCR DNA method, looking for the fingerprint, the DNA fingerprint of these four morphs. And what the FBI concluded as their primary reason for accusing Dr. Bruce Ivins of being the perpetrator, the FBI concluded that the only basically source of the attack anthrax that they could identify was one particular, I don't want to call it a flask, because I think there were two flasks that were used to store this, but it had a technical name at U.S. AMRIT at Fort Dickery called RMR-1029. It was a particular stock of anthrax that Dr. Ivins did have access to and used in his studies of vaccines, and as did other scientists at U.S. AMRIT have access to it. But the FBI concluded this RMR-1029 was the source of the attack anthrax because it, the FBI says, contained these four fingerprint morphs that had the fingerprint. Now, what our analysis showed, which was, how shall I say, substantially different than the FBI's conclusions. Well, and the FBI knew this. This is the disturbing part. Everything we're saying was known to the FBI. But what we discovered was that the RMR-1029 stock of Ames anthrax at Fort Detrick that Dr. Ivins used and others actually came in large part, about 85%, came from Dugway Proving Ground in Utah. And the way that happened was that Ivins had sent a small quantity of Ames anthrax to Dugway on behalf of Fort Detrick and said, we need you to produce a large quantity of this anthrax so we can use that in our vaccine studies. And Dugway did that. They had, I think, 19 production runs. they produced a much larger quantity, about a liter, 1,000 milliliters of this Ames anthrax, and they sent it back to Dr. Ivins. And because some of it had some subtilis contamination, Ivins discarded it and added some of his own locally produced anthrax, which is called RR-1030. And that then became what is known by the FBI as RMR-1029. And so the FBI was saying that this composite of 85% Dugway anthrax and 15% Ivins-made anthrax was the source of the murder weapon, basically, and that no one else basically had access to a source of the murder weapon with this fingerprint in it, which turned out to be completely wrong. And the reason it's completely wrong is that even though the RMR-1029 showed the four fingerprints, Dr. Ivins' RMR-1030, which is one of only two components in that stock of anthrax, did not show the fingerprint, which means, by a process of very simple elimination, that if there are two components and one of them didn't have the fingerprint, the other one must have. That other component was Dugway anthrax. So the bottom line is, our analysis showed that the FBI should have known, and it's clear from the evidence, that the fingerprint that the FBI is so focused on didn't come from Ivins, it came from Dugway, which meant that Dugway also had stocks of anthrax, at least at points in time before the attacks, that had the fingerprint morse also. So then, having concluded that, we started trying to figure out, well, if that's the case, why didn't the FBI just disclose that the Dugway stocks of anthrax also included the fingerprints, and it was something the FBI never did disclose. And what we discovered was equally disturbing, and that is that the FBI did a consensual search of Dugway. We have the documents on this. They did collect samples that had been preserved by Dugway from the production runs that went into Ivins' RMR-1029, but all of those samples obtained in the FBI search were dead. They were not live. They were not viable. Now, that actually shouldn't prevent the samples from being DNA tested, because you could still get through the PCR analysis on the dead samples. But the FBI, somewhat conveniently for its scapegoating of Dr. Ivins, decided to adopt a protocol for the testing, for the PCR DNA testing, that they didn't say it this way, but I'm going to say it this way, that no dead samples would be tested. And the way they said it was that in order to get your sample into the repository to be tested, you, the labs, the potential perpetrators, had to grow the sample and submit, a portion to the repository from the grown sample. And then they also adopted an approach that National Research Council acknowledges, that once it got to the repository, it had to be grown again by the folks who were going to be doing the PCR DNA testing or by the FBI lab. So basically, the protocol required the samples to be grown twice, and the Dugway samples wouldn't grow once because they were dead. So the Dugway samples, based on our analysis and conclusions, never got tested. And that's why you won't find any description of the Dugway results in the FBI's reports or in the NRC reports, for that matter. But the National Research Council did conclude, though, to its credit, that the evidence indicated that the Dugway anthrax would, with virtual certainty, have contained the fingerprint morse. Unfortunately, their results came out after the FBI closed its investigation. So long and short of all this is that there was strong evidence of an FBI cover-up here and a scapegoating of Dr. Ivins. And we also, thanks to the efforts of Dave Minswinkle, in contacting a number of the scientists at Fort Detrick, and as he noted, several came forward to us and have educated us quite a bit on the details of this, which were, of course, confirming what they tell us independently of them. But, we have yet to find them giving us any false information. But one of the interesting documents we got from Colonel Anderson, he likes to be called Arthur Anderson, M.D. He's not real fond of his military title, but he had one. What he disclosed was that he and his colleagues had been investigating these attacks basically in an effort to clear the name of Dr. Ivins and of their own institution, and had come up with evidence that would essentially have accomplished that task, a lot of that is found in our report. But when he went to present his evidence to the commander at Fort Detrick at U.S. Ambridge, he was told that there had been a recent visit, high-level visit by the Army, Secretary of the Army, and that during that visit, when the commander tried to raise concerns about the FBI's investigation, he was basically told to let it go and to squelch any criticism of the FBI investigation and to squelch any internal investigation of U.S. Ambridge. So there was not only an apparent cover-up by the FBI, which we documented, but there was an apparent cover-up by the U.S. Army at a certain level. So I'll leave it there, and Dave, turn it back to you, and then when you're finished, we'll see if there are any questions.
Okay. Well, listen, I don't have a lot more to say. I think that it's still in the works as to what we're doing. I think the key thing here is to get a pipeline to Congress, and we've got some possibilities we're going to be working, and try to get them to do the work, right, for us. Try to let them take it to the next step. But, you know, it's what, almost 20 years, 19 years now, since these anthrax attacks, a little over. And, again, we're doing what should have been done a long time ago. So that's not that easy to be able to do that. But fortunately, there are documents. And even more so, maybe, there are people that do remember that incident or were part of it, and they're willing to come forward, at least that some that we found from in the Fort Detrick area, and let their voices be heard. So for them to be giving us declarations for their colleague is significant. What you have to realize, too, is that this fine powdered anthrax that had not been seen really by anyone other than probably intelligence people at that time, it was so enlivened that when they went to test the sample they got from, I think it was Tom Daxel's attack letters, that the doctor who was in charge of that, who was a veteran, he opened up the envelope improperly. He thought he was taking precautions, but he wasn't. This stuff was so lively, it contaminated 12 people at Fort Detrick. So this was a strain unlike anyone had seen at that time. So in talking about bioweapons, this was a bioweapon. What it did was it opened up the door to a proliferation of private companies working in this area, and it's a very dangerous precedent. So on September 13th, they had Francis Boyle, he's a attorney, he was on a with us, we had a big gathering. You can get it on, again, on our YouTube website. It was a 3.5-hour event that Francis Boyle was there, and the guys, people like Bill Binney and Commissioner Gioia, Ray McGovern, etc. But Boyle had written the biological weapons treaty, and what was happening at that time, the law, the prevailing law, which I think is still prevailing, was that the countries were not allowed to make offensive weapons. They were allowed to do defensive work, but there was this thin line between defensive and offensive. And this was obviously an offensive weapon that was used at that time. You know, a lot of us don't remember that. I remember it too well. But it's, as I said, it's a really important possibility that it's a weak spot that we can maybe push through, because it had already been worked, and it seems to legitimize, it's being legitimized by people inside who wanted that investigation. So I don't think I have a lot more to say, but I certainly, and Mick and I, we can answer questions. Mick, you may have a few more things you want to point out.
Well, just one day, we maybe didn't state the obvious, relying on people's memories, but we should probably state the obvious, that is, These attacks, which came shortly after 9/11, targeted two United States senators. What we're basically saying is this was a biological weapons attack on Congress, and it was an attempt to assassinate two United States senators, Senator Leahy and Senator Daschle. And when you put that significant observation together with what we found, which is an FBI cover-up and an Army cover-up, and the fact that the perpetrators are still out there, you know, free to bring another biological attack to change the course of the government of the United States, if they feel the need, it's a kind of a scary situation. That's not simply a historical, you know, matter of historical interest. And there are a number of people, including Graham McQueen, who wrote a book on this, and we're looking at this issue and probably will include it in our grand jury petition coming up, that it appears, based on the timing, particularly the second wave of attacks, that those two senators were targeted because they were resisting the Bush and Cheney administration's rush of the Patriot Act through Congress. And, you know, when you put those pieces together, you've got a fairly significant ongoing concern. So I'll stop there.
Right, and that is very important. And for the grand jury petition, again, this is the future document that hopefully within a few months we'll be ready to submit it. It will go into the various crimes that were committed. And as we have enumerated one of them, probably we'll mention it would be treason. And that's what Mick is talking about here, this attack, the domestic attack on two United States senators that could have killed them. This was the most virulent anthrax seen maybe in the world up to that time, certainly in the United States at that time. If you inhaled it, there's a good chance, if you didn't get immediate assistance, you would die from it. That's what was set up. There's three different types of anthrax. One is inhalation anthrax. That will kill you. That goes into your lungs. And that's why it's fine powder, and it disperses like when they describe it in a test tube. It's like crawling up the sides of the test tube. It wants to get out. What they do is they strip it of its the polarities there, you know, so that it has no electrostatic attraction, so that it just dissipates. Nothing's holding it together. The first type of anthrax clumped together. So that was, I don't believe they had done it on the first, but this, the polarities weren't there with the electrostatic, so it just, it sort of scatters. So you think of that, you know, being let loose. So anyway, I guess that's all I have to say right now. Thanks.
Okay, great. Then let's go into Q&A mode here. And I'm going to unmute you guys again. Okay. So Mick and Dave, you both should be unmuted. And I just wanted to ask you, in terms of us helping you with this, would it be helpful for us to call Congress, the people that these documents were sent to? And if so, is there a better time to do that, you know, that would support what you're doing?
That's a good question. I can start and Dave can jump in. I don't think, you know, we're not doing this as a lobbying effort, so I want to be clear about that as a nonprofit ourselves. This is not a, you know, sort of like a request from a constituent. This is a legal filing. But we do want Congress to initiate an investigation and also to create an independent commission. So at some point in time, we're going to know, you know, where Congress stands on that. And if they do get into a discussion on it, I think that will be the time when folks other than nonprofits can freely weigh in, and if they want to, they can lobby. We can't do that, but, you know, folks who are not nonprofits, 501c3s like we are, can do that sort of lobbying legitimately. But we can let people know as this progresses and what opportunities there will be for, you know, maybe getting your own congressperson or senator to support this effort. Premature at the moment, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
I think we have to discuss with the board the strategies. I believe with, and correct me, Mick, if I'm wrong, but with regards to the World Trade Center towers, we did have a petition that was circulated. People could sign that petition, and we did submit those names to the U.S. attorney to show that there were other people besides us that wanted this to go forward. When we signed this petition, it was the Anthrax Committee did. Mick is the drafter, and all of us as key people in the anthrax committee. So all eight people on the anthrax committee, we signed it. And it's something that we can talk about as far as opening it up to the public and let everyone sign it if they wanted it, right. So that it become really very much so all of our petition.
Right. Yeah, the board may decide to do that. We'll let you know.
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, do let us know. Okay, and we have a few questions here. The first one is from Malcolm Arnold. Malcolm, go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm kind of curious as far as in your working on this, if you've researched other cases of the U.S. government using biological weapons, either intentionally or unintentionally being released. So you can look at the North Korean War, the United States used biological weapons there. They did aerosol tracing of biological agents in, I think it was the 50s or 60s, in New York subways and aerial spraying of San Francisco. You look at Lyme disease. I'm kind of curious if you found of any other examples that maybe some breadcrumbs that we can go ahead and start researching.
Well, we did. Dave, do you want to speak to that?
Well, only that if you read the petition, I believe it's in the petition. I believe it's in the congressional petition. I believe it'll be in probably in the grand jury. But a number of areas were listed, and you just mentioned some of them were the subways. In New York, and I believe in San Francisco there was an incident. Mick, you may recall more than I do, but it's certainly a common practice that I've read over the years that there's tests always being done, lots of times in populations that are controllable, like the military, because you know who's getting sick or whatever. And that had to do with maybe more or less with the vaccines and things of that nature, but with hospitals, jails, and things of that nature, colleges, where there's a population that can be monitored easily. But in the petition itself, there are, I think, maybe at least four examples of it. Mick, why don't you talk about it? You probably remember better.
Well, that's correct. I don't know if my memory is that great, but we did talk about the subway incidents, New York and San Francisco. I think one was a subway, one was another venue, but we're talking about, you know, 40s, 50s, and 60s. That's the time frame we're talking about for these studies or experiments the military did in the U.S. on U.S. citizens that they admit to now. This was a time, you know, prior to the Biological Warfare Convention, before, you know, developing offensive weapons was banned. And that we do attach in our petition as one of our exhibits a New York Times article, which, you know, strangely enough, came out just before 9/11 and just before the anthrax attacks, describing secret experiments in the U.S., including from the U.S. military and including Battelle. So you'll get some information. That article gives some of the history background you're referring to. I wouldn't say we've done an encyclopedic study of the history of the use and misuse of biological weapons by the U.S. We do have a longer detailed chronology that we're planning to include. We'll see how the final version comes out in our petition to the grand jury, more than what we gave to Congress. We're probably going to get into more of that historical detail there.
Yeah, another incident is also the Legionnaires' disease outbreak at a veterans' banquet meeting. That happened. There was some, right, if I recall, I read some literature on that may be another instance, but also you talk about college students and stuff like that. That's been testing grounds as well. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks, Malcolm. And next we have Jessica Coco. Jessica, go ahead. Jessica, are you with us?
Can you hear me? Hi, it's Eric. Hello?
Jessica?
Hi, Eric here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Are you? Go ahead.
Yeah, there's two aspects about this anthrax attack that interest me. One is that the Vice President of the United States apparently began to take an antidote for anthrax a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks before the actual attacks occurred. And I wonder if anybody looked into that. How did they? Why would they have started doing that? And by the way, I think that it was noted in a recent article that that followed his taking of this Cipro antidote followed a meeting between himself and people who originated a bioterror exercise in the summer of that year called Dark Winter. Of course, we heard Joe Biden refer to that just in the recent debate. These people that organized that exercise apparently visited the vice president's office, and among them were this Tom Inglesby character, who organized that, or partially organized the bioweapons attack scenario that summer. So when Inglesby visits Cheney, pretty soon after that, Cheney starts to take an antidote for anthrax. And that's one thing, if anybody could comment on that. And the second one, very briefly, is that there was apparently a significant press campaign that was organized right after these attacks to blame the attacks on Iraq. And there's quite a lot of information about that. There were some people apparently behind this press campaign to blame the anthrax attacks on Iraq. That is before the information came out that the everything you're talking about, you know. So there are some behind-the-scenes things going on there that indicate some possible guilty parties floating around out there. So anyway, I just thought I'd mention these two aspects and see if anybody wants to comment on that.
Sure.
You want to go first? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. We know that, and we didn't get into this that much yet, and maybe we will more with the grand jury, but from what I read, that Cheney and Bush were given Cipro, but I'd heard, not Tom Inglesby, he might have been seeing him, I didn't know that, but Jerome Hauer, that's who I heard it came through. And Jerome Hauer had been an executive with Kroll Security in the World Trade Center, in particular 7. In fact, it was his idea to put the Emergency Management Center up in the 23rd floor, Building 7. And he is an interesting character. Now, Inglesby that you mentioned, he shows up with this Crimson Contagion or Purple Contagion or whatever, which is the exercise prior to our pandemic, basically. Now, we haven't taken any position on the present pandemic or anything like that, but there is a mentioning his name with Dark Winter. You'd have to mention it also with the Dark Winter preceded the anthrax attacks, and Inglesby is still involved, I believe, and others that were involved in writing those scripts and orchestrating those exercises. Were also involved in Crimson Contagion. So I'm not sure if it was, like you said, a week before, but it's certainly curious that it was, my understanding, and Mick may have a better date on that, it was certainly on that day or the day after that the president and his staff, the vice president, were given Cipro. And it's curious, to say the least. Mick?
Yeah, so we do have some information regarding the Cheney and White House folks taking Cipro in advance of the anthrax attacks. As you may or may not know, Barbara Honegger, who is often on your calls, is one of our anthrax committee members and has been working with us on this and has brought the Dark Winter information to our attention, and that may show up in more substantial form in our grand jury petition. The exact timing of when the vice president and members of the White House and others, maybe in Congress, were taking Cipro, which at that time, was the drug that Bayer had the patent on and didn't want to lower its prices during the emergency, which made a lot of folks unhappy. But it was at that time the antibiotic of choice. It's no longer the antibiotic of choice for anthrax. But, you know, there is apparently some truth to the story that some folks were taking Cipro before the anthrax attacks were publicized or known to have occurred, which raises interesting questions. It's also true that there were media reports, we referenced some of them in our congressional petition, that reported that administration officials, some unnamed, wanted to blame or focus attention on both Al-Qaeda and Iraq. Iraq as the source of the anthrax and Al-Qaeda as the delivery boys, neither of which turned out to be true, of course. So that is documented. So I think that's probably the best I can tell you at the moment, but I think, you know, the points you raise are have a basis in fact.
Okay. All set, Eric?
Yes.
Okay, this is gone. Okay, thank you. Okay, next up we have David Rolls. David, go ahead.
Thank you. So the 9/11 attacks on the towers and the Pentagon, I mean, it was totally obvious that the official story couldn't be true and that it had to be an inside job. And but the government like went ahead like to this day insisting that it was these 20 Saudis and other Arabs who did it in this like ludicrous conspiracy theory. And so I'm just wondering what is different about the anthrax attacks that the U.S. government didn't stick with their story blaming Iraq, even though everybody, you know, I just don't get why they allowed the blame to be deflected to an American and like let the official story be that it was an inside job. I just don't understand what's different about it.
Well, you know, it's a very good question, and there's some thoughts I'm not going to share with the group because I have to share with the board. It's some of the things I've been asking myself. All right, but it's a good question. And if we remember, there was two batches of this anthrax, apparently, and I guess we can only assume. Now, the FBI said it was a lone wolf that did it, but it would seem that it may have been even a team that did it. You know, again, that's not based on anything really sound right now, other than the almost the impossibility of one person carrying this off. So why would, I guess the question is why would the government allow the alleged suspects that would be like Al-Qaeda or like Iraq off the hook? And why would they allow it to be directed inward towards possibly themselves? And it's a good question. When it was directed inward, what we have to realize is there was a big argument right at the beginning between Battelle, who was doing work, I believe, for the FBI, to assess the potency of the anthrax. I think it was a Daxil anthrax. And also the Army that's Fort Detrick. They were looking at this very virulent and energetic anthrax, and the Army was saying this is off the chart. We've not seen anything like this. And Battelle is saying, no, it's 10 times or more less potent than normal anthrax, or something to that extent. Where the Army is saying it's like 10 times more potent than anything we've ever seen. And the Army colonel got really irate with the Battelle executive, and he says, you guys autoclaved it, and basically they baked it so that it was like puppy chow, he said, or something like that. And then they analyzed it. All right. So there seems to be at that time an effort to put suspicion on Fort Detrick, which is interesting because, I mean, all of us probably have heard Fort Detrick over the years, and you always think of, they have like a negative connotation to Fort Detrick, you know, the bioweapons center, et cetera. But in this case, ironically, and we've talked to and met some of the scientists, these guys are good guys, and they were being really persecuted by the FBI. And they were sort of like told not to talk to each other, and they isolated Ivins very badly, and they broke him away from his friends, and they embarrassed him at his work, embarrassed him at his home, and other things we haven't investigated yet, but they might even set him up with a therapist that was his confident therapist, who basically becomes sort of more or less an informant, it seems like, for the FBI, but that hasn't been investigated yet. So it seems like when they did turn internally, and remember, this wasn't, at first they didn't go after the scientists at USIMRID. The first group of, there was two fellows that worked in Pennsylvania, I think at Levittown, in the city hall, and they were of, I think, Muslim descent, and they were had green cards, but they both had good jobs in the city, and they were persecuted. And they had to leave their job. They lost their jobs. And then they went after a doctor in New York, and they went after him hard, and he had a lot of problems, and eventually, you know, he withered it. And then they went after a guy named Perry Mikesell, who worked at Battelle, but he also worked at USIMRID. And he, all of a sudden, he's drinking a lot, and he dies. Then they go after another USIMRID scientist, that's Stephen Hatfield, and this lasted for a couple of years. And they made a circus out of it. When they did a search warrant, everybody in the town knew about it, basically, because the television camera was there rolling and the press was there. Totally embarrassing his life until he turned it on him. He had a public news conference, and he went after them and sued them, and he won over $5 million. And then they went after Bruce Ivins, and then they closed the case. After he died, whether he died legitimately, whether he died at his own hand or whether he had some help, we don't know that. Maybe we'll find out if he was murdered or not. But, and, you know, so they wanted it to stop at that point. But you raise a really good point, because this is something here to think about, is that of the samples that turned in this, the Ames strain, 17 of them were from the United States, the different companies or laboratories or whatever. Three of them were foreign. So it's not to say that, you know, the Ames strain and this type of anthrax couldn't have come from another country. It's just that it was an American strain, you know, but as I'm not sure if we went into that in our presentations, but hundreds of people had access to that RMR 1029 flask that they said that Ivins was the sole custodian of. That was a lot of, you know, that wasn't true at all. Hundreds of people had access to it. And people from Battelle had access to that 1029. People had from Dugway had it, and people from USIMRID had it. And then other scientists from other countries had it. So it could be a Pandora's box to open up and where it ends. It's a great question you asked. It's a question I've asked myself just even recently about that, because something maybe doesn't make sense right now. And that's why you do investigations, to put it together. And thanks for that great question.
Let me, before we go on, let me add my two cents on that question. It is a good one about why the cover-up broke down on the anthrax attacks, and it didn't break down as efficiently or quickly on the Trade Center attacks. And we haven't finished our inquiry on this, and there are things that, you know, we can't talk about until we do. But a couple, you know, theories to keep in mind is, one is that the anthrax attacks may not have been planned as well in advance as the Trade Center attacks. And it's possible that the anthrax attacks were initiated only because something went wrong with the original plan. And without going into detail, that is a working hypothesis of mine. And, you know, when you try to do something complex like this, quick and dirty, things can go wrong, and your initial cover story can break down pretty quickly because you didn't have time to perfect it. And that may have happened with the anthrax attacks because it was not as long planned. So the long series of attempts by the FBI, with, I'm sure, encouragement from others, to blame these attacks, you know, on one U.S. scientist or another, over a course of many years was Plan B on the cover-up. You know, Plan A was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and that didn't work. The reason it fell apart quickly, I think, is because there were people with integrity in the FBI, one of whom was Rick Lambert, who controlled the FBI investigation for 4 years before he was removed, probably for attempting to do his job too well. And if you read our report, you'll see that we quote, or at least paraphrase, from Rick Lambert in his federal court lawsuit alleging retaliation against him by the federal government, that there were probably 10 to 20 concrete examples he gave from personal knowledge of how his own investigation was obstructed by the FBI itself. But nonetheless, notwithstanding those efforts, he did try to do the right thing. And one of the things he tried to do was to get the full power of science brought to bear in the investigation on these attack anthrax samples. And it just happened that there were, you know, it was the time in history when the DNA technology was evolving. And it's very possible that the perpetrators didn't realize that this, you know, sort of fingerprint could be developed, DNA fingerprint, which, you know, it does actually point to people who had the ability to access anthrax of the type used in the attacks. It just doesn't point to Bruce Ivins, like the FBI said. And if you combine the B. subtilis contamination and the silicone inner coating, you get, you know, a lot of evidence pointing to Battelle and Dugway as where the anthrax probably originated. Doesn't mean they, you know, did the letters. But, you know, I think the science and the fact that there were some people in the FBI with integrity still in the investigation caused that initial cover story to break down pretty rapidly.
Right. And I think this is important, too. And sometimes we don't see the forest for the trees. But, again, 19 years later, they may have not anticipated a group like the Lawyers Committee going through these FBI vaults and making contact with scientists that were there, and the FBI inspector was there, and start a new investigation. And in other words, they got away with it. They solved the case. If you read their summary, the 96-page summary they put out, Ivins is the killer. And if he had lived, they would have proved it in court. Well, we don't believe that's true at all. I don't think they would be able to prove anything other than that they were on a witch hunt to get him and to set him up. But they don't have to worry about that right now because they feel that they covered their rear end. And now we're coming to uncover it. And again, there was a lot of people back then, as we mentioned, the New York Times and Washington Post and Rush Holt and Jared Nadler and Russ Gradley and Patrick Leahy was involved.
Senator, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, these guys are still, they're all alive still, as far as I know, but they didn't have any reason to carry it forward. Now, we're going to try and give them a reason. Now, they might not take on to it. They might say this is, you know, I'm out of the loop, or this is too old, I don't have the energy for it, or there's more important issues. But some of them, or even only just one of them we need just to open up the doors for us. And, you know, you'll see that history is being rewritten. And so that saying something about the 9/11 truth movement, we may be able to rewrite history. Of course, we have, and I don't know if Mick talked about it, we have a lawsuit going on in New York City on the explosive evidence and bombs, explosions in the buildings, the towers that brought them down. It would be interesting. We're waiting for a judge's order right now or to a ruling to tell us if we're going to have a grand jury or not, basically. So that's kind of exciting. And as I said before, there was a grand jury here before. So this is a little bit easier. We don't have to prove controlled demolition or bombs or anything like that. All we have to do is, you know, the anthrax has already been established. It's anthrax, the type of anthrax. All we're looking at is the suspects now. Who's a possible suspect? So that's a lot easier than saying what was the cause, you know, the mechanical cause or the substance that brought the buildings down, or what was the substance that was sent to Daxel? Well, we know it was anthrax. We know the Ames anthrax. We know it was a sophisticated bioweapon. We know that. We know where it comes from in a sense of the type of strain it is. So it makes it a little bit easier, and that's why, you know, I think we think that it's, this is, you know, quite a possibility if we keep it going. We have to keep it going.
Okay. Thank you for the question, David. And next we have Sherry Jacobs. Sherry, go ahead.
Hi, this is Sherry, and I was wondering if you could please tell me, Mick, what date did the mandamus lawsuit get filed?
Well, I could tell you. I don't have it in my brain at the moment. I can try to look it up while we're talking.
Okay, I'm putting together a bulleted list of all the litigations in sequential order because I'm designing the for our new fundraiser that we're going to launch with Custom Ink for the shirt. So, and so I was wondering about that people of material interest. Is did I say that correct? Wasn't that something that you filed as well, something like that?
Well, let's be clear. We're talking about the case in New York, federal case, where we're suing the U.S. attorney to force the U.S. attorney to give our grand jury petition to the grand jury for which it was intended, with all the evidence of the demolition. That's the case we're talking about. We call it a mandamus case because we're using a federal statute that says you can sue to mandate a federal official to do their duty when they have a non-discretionary duty to do, and that is the case here. Because it's not, a lot of people don't realize still that it's not the U.S. attorney's discretion whether or not to give a report of a federal crime to a grand jury. They're obligated to do that. So we did submit, in addition to our original petition to the grand jury and the U.S. attorney, a supplement, and it did talk about persons who have material information. It wasn't quite as you described it, but it's...
Okay, that's the supplement. Okay, all right.
Yeah, but, it, you know, people use different terms, and we're trying not to call anybody a suspect or a perpetrator because we don't have the grand jury's subpoena power or the U.S. attorney's and the power to, you know, subpoena witnesses and put people under oath and make plea deals and stuff. There's evidence that, you know, we will have a challenge developing that they could get pretty straightforward, and they're going to be in a better position to name names when they do, you know, the investigation using those powers. So we're cautious in what we say, but what we did attempt to do was bring to the U.S. attorney's attention and the grand jury's, you know, people who may have material information, they may have that because they're a witness, they may have that because they did their own investigation, maybe a scientist, or they might have it because they are a possible perpetrator. So I'm going to look up that date for you, Sherry, and I'll let you know as we go along here.
No worries. Okay, and then one more question. I was wondering what happened to the FOIA, our FOIA lawsuit or the FOIA request for the Pentagon videos and where that stands.
Dave, do you want to respond to that, or shall I?
Well, you can do it. I'll just give you a little introduction to that. That was the 9/11 Review Commission illegal action that was a mandamus action, too, because, the FBI was mandated by Congress to assess all information 9/11 related that hadn't been assessed originally to consider. Had been assessed by the original 9/11 Commission, and we gave seven areas. If I can remember them, was the first area had to do with the World Trade Center controlled demolition evidence, the explosive evidence. The second had to do with the dancing Israelis or the high fibers. The third had to do with the destruction of evidence, having to do with those photos which you were trying to get. Fourth had to do with Saudi financing. The fifth, that's the one you're asking for, had to do with the Pentagon photos. I believe we found out there was like 16 cameras that nobody knew about, or maybe there was more than that. And then the seventh had to do with plane parts because they have serial numbers on them, and the serial numbers are indicative of the plane itself, so there's a lot of questions as to what each plane did. And the last, seventh one, had to do with cell phone communications because there's a lot of problems with the cell phones becoming air phones and calls that supposedly were made that weren't made. So in reference to that, Sherry, that's under appeal right now, I believe, and Mick can take it from here because he is working on that as we speak.
So, yeah, there are two actions that relate to the Pentagon videos that you're asking about, Sherry. One is the one Dave just described, which, if we were to win it, would force the FBI to go back and essentially evaluate all that evidence, because the 9/11 Commission did not. And that suit is about the congressional mandate to force the FBI to look at all the 9/11 evidence that the original commission did not look at. That's on appeal in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And we have an oral argument scheduled in that case in December of this year. Now, the other thing we have relating to the Pentagon videos is an actual Freedom of Information request. It's not a litigation yet. And there were some other folks who did FOIA requests on that. And Dave may remember, I think Gene LaRotonda is one of those people who asked for those videos. And we're supportive of that. I'm not sure at the moment. I think it's probably, I remember there being an issue about who was going to pay the cost and how much the cost would be. And then we offered to basically pay it. And then I think the agency is stalling at that point. I have to go back and check that, Sherry, but I believe that's waiting on us to probably force the agency's hand.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Thanks, Sherry.
I have the date for Sherry at the moment.
Okay.
The mandamus complaint was filed on September the 10th, 2019.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, and then we have one last question here. It's from Carl Golovin. Carl, go ahead.
David, Mick, hi. Thank you for your work and your presentation. I have a question slightly off topic concerning whistleblower complaints. How long after an event, or how long after even one is retired from an agency, can one bring a whistleblower complaint, and is there any benefit in that? My context is, as you, I think I've discussed with both of you, as a Customs Internal Affairs agent, I was one of dozens of Internal Affairs agents who were assigned to work on sifting machinery at Fresh Kills Landfill, specifically tasked to sift electronic or computer components out of the rubble of World Trade Center 7. Our tasking was that CIA and Secret Service didn't want any of their computer components left in the rubble. They had, of course, been occupants of the building. But in retrospect, especially given what AE 9/11 Truth has proven, that it's a controlled demolition, I suspect that our work also may have served to help cover up things by sifting out, for example, any undestroyed demolition electronics that might have resulted from perhaps a botched initial demolition attempt earlier in the morning on 9/11. So is it too late, or would there be any interest or benefit in filing this many years later a whistleblower complaint? There are certainly lots of records about our sifting of that rubble.
Well, I can start with that as a whistleblower attorney. There are different kinds of whistleblower complaints. So let me ask you first a question to clarify. Are you perceiving that you yourself have received retaliation for having done something protected by the Federal Whistleblower Protection Act or some other federal law? Or are you more talking about a disclosure of wrongdoing that doesn't relate to retaliation against you?
Well, I think both, actually. To an extent, when I left the government, I was eligible initially in 2007 at 50. I left for reasons that things I wanted to do, but also I was feeling some pressure to which I could not really identify the source, but I had spoken openly with my colleagues about concerns that the official story of 9/11 was not true, even at that point, from what I had learned of Stephen Jones and his research. I don't know at this point whether some of that pressure, which actually could be fairly well documented, I was reassigned between two different positions within that year prior to my deciding to leave. And I left, of course, because I wanted to get involved in Ron Paul's campaign. I was ultimately hired to be his security director. So, yeah, that was something I'll never regret having left to do that. But it could be both.
Okay, so if you're a federal employee or former federal employee, I can double check this for you, but I'm relatively certain that if you make a disclosure to the Office of Special Counsel, there were a wrongdoing of a type addressed by a federal statute, particularly the Whistleblower Protection Act, or retaliation, or both, that there is not a time limit, to my knowledge, on going that particular route. If you wanted to argue you were constructively discharged by being forced to leave, there would be a time limit on that, and I'm pretty sure that time limit would have passed. I think it's like, I mean, it's very short for the Whistleblower Protection Act. It's like 60 days, 120 days, something like that. So it's not years. Now, there are other laws that can be talked about, and if you really want to get into the details, you'll need to consult a federal whistleblower attorney and talk about the ins and outs of your situation. But, you know, I believe disclosures can be made to the Office of Special Counsel, and then if they don't rule for you, I believe those can be appealed to the Merit System Protection Board, just as if you had brought an action directly to the board initially on your departure. So there's probably a way still to address it if you feel like there's enough merit there.
Well, I think the merit would be especially concerning the wrongdoing of the cover-up of 9/11 and the fact that myself and my work and the work of colleagues was arguably used to cover up what happened to World Trade Center 7.
Well, the devil's in the details, so it's probably not a conversation for this big of an audience.
Okay.
I have
lots of documentation of our work schedules and assignment at Fresh Kills, also photographs. So be pleased to speak with you about that offline.
Well, you're welcome to do that. You may want to bring it to the Lawyers Committee Board as a group. We don't represent people at the moment. We do support lawyers who do represent people. I'm one of them. But, you know, the devil's in the details. So I'm happy to chat with you when my schedule would allow, which will be in the next couple of weeks. But maybe after that, we could set something up.
That'll be great. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Dave,
all right. Thank
Dave
you.
Wanted to add anything to that or not?
No. I think you covered it, Mick. With the statute of limitations, very brief.
Yeah.
It's only brief as to retaliation, but not as to agency wrongdoing?
No, it's if you go to USC, it's not brief as to retaliation either. The Office of Special Counsel does not have a time limit for either type of case, to my knowledge.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Okay, and Mick and Dave, we have actually one last question. It's from Greg Longo. Greg, go ahead.
Are you familiar with the person who was had a PhD? He was working in the Fort Detrick lab, the anthrax lab, and was caught there after hours. I remember reading that in the New York Times.
Well, that's Dr. Bruce Ivins we've been talking about. He's the one who was scapegoated.
No, it was not Bruce Ivins.
You mean another scientist working after hours. Go ahead.
Colonel David France, maybe. Maybe. Does that ring a bell, David France?
That rings a bell, yes.
Yeah, I think There was an incident that happened actually right before the anthrax, and it involved a gentleman that was of Middle Eastern descent who worked at USEMRID, and there was a nasty letter that was sent to, I think it's the Quantico FBI, saying about bioweapons and basically making him look like he may be a suspect before an event even happened. And I don't think it mentioned anthrax so much as a bioweapons attack. And some people thought that there was an organization at that time that was seemed to be very discriminatory called the Camel Club. And there was a group of scientists that used to meet every week, and they used to make fun of him, supposedly. And he always won the war to being a camel. And eventually he was let go along with some other scientists that were not from this country when there was some cutbacks, although they were very... very advanced scientists, and they thought there was some discrimination involved there. So that may be what you're talking about. We briefly looked at that at the beginning. It seemed like that was something that, although it was timed synchronistically, about that time, and maybe it wasn't totally connected. They're totally connected. And we had actually reached out to that scientist, and it was very difficult to make contact with him. And in fact, we talked to his attorney. Right.
So guys, that particular incident did not involve somebody working late hours in the lab.
No, it didn't. But it did. It may have involved this guy going in there with his girlfriend.
That's a different matter.
Yeah. Also, was a scientist, I believe. There, for Daybreak. Maybe that's what you're talking about. All right.
What do you mean by a Middle East accent? Or
I forget what.
Can you name the country?
You can look. I think the guy's name was Assad, Dr. Assad.
No, it wasn't Dr. Assad. It was an Israeli. Israeli.
You're talking about two different people. What Dave's talking about is Dr. Assad. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm talking about the guy who was in the lab at Fort Detrick after hours, the anthrax lab. He was eventually fired.
What year are you talking about?
Yeah, there is a guy. I forget his name right now. You're 100% right. I forget the name now. We know that name, Mick. We actually considered him briefly at the beginning. John O'Kelly could help us out with that. You're right. There was a fellow, but we didn't see the connection. We looked into it briefly. We did look into the connection.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so that's the end of the questions. Thank you, Mick and Dave, so much for coming on and filling us in on all of that. And, gosh, thanks for the work you're doing. It's really amazing what you guys are accomplishing.
Well, thanks a lot for you guys. And let me just tell you that we're working hard on this anthrax. As I said, we have the anthrax petition to the grand jury we're working on. The next grand jury petition we hope to do will be one on government misconduct and obstruction. That'll be a gigantic endeavor because every federal department probably looked at, and every federal department probably in some way didn't do that day of 9/11 what they normally do that allow this to happen. Another thing we'll be doing is hopefully a massive campaign, a FOIA campaign, and we'll be letting the public know about that. The bottom line is in order to keep going and sustain ourselves, we have to raise money. So if you know ways to help us raise some money, that would be very helpful. Right? Sherry mentioned about she's going to be setting up a sort of merchandise where you can buy different various articles, and that money will be used to help our investigation. So that's one good way to contribute. All right. So thanks a lot, though, for you guys keeping the torch going. Because as much as maybe in some ways we inspire you, you inspire us. Okay, thank you.
Okay, great. All right, and hopefully you'll join us in a couple months when you have more updates. And I just had one last thing. I want to know, when does that judge in New York, does he have a deadline when he has to get back to you?
Well, not a date certain. He does have individual rules that he has established that only apply to, his cases. And he asks that the attorneys remind him if he doesn't make a decision on a motion within, I forget what the number of days is, maybe 120 days. That date has passed. And the person who filed the motion, the attorney who filed the motion, is supposed to remind him. So the government actually filed the motion that the court is currently deliberating on. So we had to remind the government attorney to remind the judge that time under his rule had passed, and the government agreed and did remind the judge, but we haven't seen a decision yet. So the only other potential limitation would be, whatever a court of appeals might consider to be a completely unreasonable time frame that might subject the judge to a mandamus action to force a decision, and that's, we're probably talking years, not months, for something like that.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. Okay, great. Well, thank you again, and we're going to do announcements and stuff. You're welcome to stay on or leave if you need to. So at this point, we're into announcements, comments. Does anyone have any updates or anything they want to share with everyone? Let me get us out of Q&A and out of mute just a moment.
This is Sherry, and I have an announcement.
Yeah, go ahead, Sherry.
Okay, we are going to be being, like Dave said, a fundraiser for the Lawyers Committee to raise funds for the litigation that we just spoke about. It's your custom made. We did it before and raised like $36 in 4 weeks, so we're going to do it 4 week campaign. They are the same shirts as we had last time. We did one t-shirt, long sleeve, co-ed. We're adding collar polo shirts and a hoodie. So, you know, look for that when you get that link. And the only way that we can make money for them is to all share it on our social media. So people, you can, last time it was wonderful because Custom Ink gives us like a web page.
Sherry, it's a little bit hard to hear you. Are you, I don't know, is there anything you can do to?
Sound speaker. So anyway, look for this fundraiser and share it. It's a very cool fundraiser where you can put a comment. Last time we had 10 pages of heartfelt comments and we raised like $3,600 in 4 weeks. So we're going to do a 4 week campaign. So look for that to get your historical Lawyers Committee shirts. And that's all. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. For anybody else?
Okay.
I had one thing I noticed today. I got this the Psychology Today magazine for this month, and their cover story is Conspiracy Theories, Why Smart People Fall for Bizarre Ideas. And so they have on the front cover Area 51, COVID-19 and 5G, QAnon, Who Killed JFK, Chemtrails, Elvis Alive, The Illuminati, Pizzagate, CIA Mind Control. But in the article, interestingly, they do not mention 9/11 at all, and I thought that was interesting, and I think it's probably because we are so organized and have so much research that maybe they've decided it's not wise to go there. I don't know, but they didn't mention 9/11. It's kind of a crappy article with the same old psychological BS about why we do what we do. But I would like to contact the author and complain or, you know. So if anyone's interested in looking at that article, it's in Psychology Today. Hmm. Just wanted to share that.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Thank you.
Okay, I guess not. Well, all right, then. Great. Thanks, everyone, for joining tonight's call. And if you have any ideas for speakers, anybody you want to hear or any thoughts? All right.
This is David. I'd still like to have a speaker or a debate to figure out if this COVID virus really exists or not.
Okay. Does it exist? Do you have any ideas on that? I guess that Andy Kaufman, right? He's been good on
right,
that.
Right. He was an idea. John Rappaport's been writing about it, and what's the guy's name in Canada? Dennis Rancourt has been arguing that it does exist. So,
his name is Rancourt.
Yeah, or Rancourt if it's French. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, if you could send me any information on him, I don't know anything about him. I'll try and contact him.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Anybody else have ideas?
If John Rappaport's available, his domain is nomorefakenews.com, and he's, of course, written extensively about fake aspects of COVID, but I believe years ago he may have also written about 9/11, and I don't think what he wrote years ago is available online, so it would be interesting if he could speak to both issues.
Yeah, I tried to reach him, and he doesn't respond to me. Does anyone else have through his website, does anyone have his personal email or a way to contact him?
You know who might is G. Edward Griffin had him on, at least to provide a video commentary, which I think was pre-recorded of Rappaport during the Red Pill Expo .com, the conference just a couple of weeks ago at Jekyll Island. So G. Edward Griffin via Red Pill University, I think that's his entity, redpilluniversity.org, that he would have contact capability with Rappaport.
Okay. I'll see if I can follow up on that. And as I said, he just didn't respond, so maybe he's not interested in our group or what we offer. I don't know. But I'll check it out again. Okay. And if anyone else thinks of anything, please email me. I'd appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, have a good month. We'll see you in November.
Thank you.
Okay. Night, everyone.